Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Vonage. With Vonage Voice API, you get comprehensive call analytics, virtual assistants, automated speech recognition, and text-to-speech benefits across multiple languages. Developers can add smart voice functionalities into your app, giving your customers an easier way to reach you. And you can start collecting real-time data to drive more meaningful engagement to move your business forward. Learn more at Vonage.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Back in the days when swing was king, the crown belonged to Tommy Dorsey. He was born Thomas Francis Dorsey Jr. on November 19, 1905, in Shenandoah, Pennsylvania. His father, a coal miner turned local band leader, vowed to do anything to keep his boys out of the mines. First son Jimmy excelled on alto sax. Tommy took to the trombone. The rest is history. From 1928 to 33, Tommy and Jimmy co-led the Dorsey Brothers Orchestra. Their split in 1935 made headlines. Tommy never looked back. He went on to become one of the biggest names in the big band era. The Tommy Dorsey Orchestra topped the charts with Marie and Opus No. 1 and many more. The music was Good Times, Moonlight, and Roses. The reality was, for the nation, a lot of tough times. And for Tommy Dorsey, the so-called sentimental gentleman of swing, a volcanic temper and a single-minded pursuit of fame and fortune. This hour, On Point, the music, Tommy Dorsey the man, and America's swinging years. You can join the conversation, were you part of it, living large on the dance floor through some very hard times of depression and war? Are you part of the swing revival now? And what does this iconic music mean to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Later this hour, we'll be joined by two former members of the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, clarinetist Buddy DeFranco and singer Ann Clark Terry. Right now, I'm joined from New York by writer and music biographer Peter Levinson. He spent years interviewing scores of people who knew Tommy Dorsey. His new book, Tommy Dorsey, Living in a Great Big Way, a biography, is an eye-opener. Levinson also wrote Trumpet Blues, The Life of Harry James, and September in the Rain, The Life of Nelson Riddle. Peter Levinson, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Wonderful to have you. And there's a very smooth Tommy Dorsey behind us. What are we listening to there, Peter?
His wonderful theme, I'm Getting Sentimental Over You.
So here was a man who took American music through such a range of times, the real, real down-and-out tough times of the Depression, through war, through victory, right into the 50s, and all that meant. Was Tommy Dorsey in touch with his times? Was he consciously making a soundtrack for that part of the American century?
I don't know that he really was conscious of what he was contributing and as you say, forming the soundtrack of the times. He wanted to achieve greatness with his music, and he's driven by tremendous discipline and drive and the constant striving for perfectionism. And through all of those attributes, maybe some more important than others, he managed to achieve a great deal of fame based on real brilliance as a leader and also as a trombonist.
Peter Levinson, take us back to how Americans heard this music in that nearly, 20 years and more that Tommy Dorsey was so big. What was the country looking for in the big band era, in the swing era? What did they get in this music?
Well, I think, Tom, the central thing here in the year of 1935 when Benny Goodman and his orchestra burst through and supposedly the swing era started in Los Angeles in August of 1935, I think there was an atmosphere created by the first year and a half of the New Deal of Franklin D. Roosevelt that there was a man in the White House who cared for the common man, a man who had been afflicted with polio and understood the terrible nature of what was going on with the people of America. And, of course, the great first 100 days of tremendous social legislation, which carried on into the next year and so forth. There was an atmosphere that somebody was interested in us, so to speak, And I think that allowed a certain freedom of music. Now, swing music really wasn't new. The Dorsey Brothers Orchestra that you mentioned earlier of Tommy Jimmy, Louis Armstrong's big band, Duke Ellington, they were important, but they weren't called swing. But suddenly, in August of 35, Benny Goodman became the king of swing. So that I think the New Deal had a lot to do with opening up the mind and the feeling of Americans who wanted a music that could be danced to and gave a certain freedom to the country, because the country was not on its knees, it was on its back in the years of the end of 1929 through 33.
So you see it as a kind of breakout of people's music in a way, but to my ear today and for decades now, when I hear this music, and maybe this is the imprint Hollywood has put on it, you know, I hear glamour and shimmer and satin gowns.
Well, that's, I think Hollywood had a lot to do with it. And, of course, bandleaders were starring roles. Usually the bandleader was the best friend of the male lead and featured bands a lot in a lot of scenes, and that gave it a certain romantic tinge to it.
Take us back to when this was breaking on the scene. Do you remember the first time you heard Tommy Dorsey?
Well, I can't say that I can remember the first time, other than the fact that I was 10 years old when one of his biggest records, Opus No. 1, was released. And that record was so huge that disc jockey shows all over the country used it as a theme. And I never met Tommy, but I was there at the very first date that Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey played, which was, I believe, it's in the book, it's, I think April the 12th or 16th, something like that. 1953 at the University of Virginia at their annual Easter's weekend, and the band played a concert on a Saturday afternoon, and I have a picture from the book, Living in a Great Big Way, showing Tommy and Jimmy.
This is Opus No. 1, the one you remember from when you were 10 years old.
Yeah.
And, of course, for all Americans, this is really associated, to my mind anyway, with wartime and guys on leave.
And what's so strange about this, as a publicist named Phoebe Jacobs said, you know, that song was the sound of a winner. And I think when it was released, of course, Eisenhower's troops had crossed the Rhine. MacArthur had landed on Leyte in the Philippines. The tide had turned in the war. And yet Cy Oliver wrote this tune in early 1942 when the news from the war front was decidedly dismal.
Maybe just another example of how a lot of this music was counter the times, counter trends.
That's right.
In
That's
depression,
right.
It was lift us up. In dark times of war, it was anticipating victory even before it was at all in sight.
Exactly.
But we have the images of people just dancing to this with a lot of VJ Day kind of energy a couple of years later.
That's right.
It's still a great sound. Who was Tommy Dorsey? We were saying he came out of coal country, his father a miner, but a miner who became a band leader. That's not your everyday miner.
No. Thomas F. Dorsey Sr. was the original driven Dorsey. And, of course, he instilled that in his two sons, especially Tommy, who, of course, most people think was the older. In reality, he was, I believe, 16 months younger. But I think there's something that made Tommy as driven as he was, and as tough as he was, in that he wore glasses. And I think men, as little boys, if they wore glasses, they were called sissies and things like that.
This is because the old four-eyes glasses days.
Mm-hmm. And four-eyes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think that had a lot to do with his trying to gain an inner strength and a physical strength, both of which were certainly of major importance to him. Mm-hmm. And I think that gave him the tough veneer that certainly was a great part of him.
Now, his brother was on the alto sax, Tommy Dorsey on the trombone, and his style of trombone play had a lot to do with defining his career, his band, and even the careers of vocalists who came after him, Frank Sinatra.
He knew how to showcase vocalists probably better than anybody else, which Frank Sinatra totally realized when he was offered the chance to go with Dorsey. And, of course, his wife was pregnant with what became Nancy Sinatra, and he needed money. But he also knew he had the opportunity of a lifetime, because the guy who essentially, although there were two short-lived vocalists who replaced him, Jack Leonard, had been with Dorsey and had a total of 39 vocal hits. So Sinatra knew that the male band singer would be very well showcased, and he would be suddenly that band vocalist, and he would really get a shot.
We'll come back and look at Tommy Dorsey and the vocalist he worked with, but talk to us about Tommy Dorsey's trombone technique and what he brought to that.
Well, that technique, there was a trombonist in the 20s who was very important in recording in jazz circles named Miff Mole, and he got a lot from him. The trombonist, of course, he revered to the end of his life, and because that was Jack Teagarden, who he knew he could never equal as a jazz and blues trombonist. And this tremendous regard for Teagarden, as I say, he never lost sight of that. Jack was what he wished he could be. In fact, he referred to his own ability as a jazz trombonist by calling his playing of jazz as Civil War jazz.
Meaning?
Meaning it's kind of antiquated.
It's sort of a ballad style, that legato.
Style, however, he could play like nobody has ever done. I mean, he could caress a melody better than anybody who ever played the instrument.
And
it gave, of course, a romantic feel to the music. And, of course, playing that kind of trombone behind a vocal group, as in the Pied Pipers or Frank Sinatra and Connie Haynes and people like that, it certainly gave a romantic aura to their music.
And this was a day when a band leader would be on the instrument himself and really making an impression with it, kind of setting the tone for a whole big band.
That's right. The first chorus, after the opening, the first chorus always featured the Dorsey trombone.
We're talking this hour about Tommy Dorsey, the big band era in America's swinging years. My guest is Peter Levinson. He's got a brand new bio out, Tommy Dorsey, Living in a Great Big Way. You can join us. Were you part of it? Living large on the dance floor through the same very hard times Tommy Dorsey did, of depression and war. Are you part of it now, of the swing revival, or does it seem a million miles away, another America, another time? We'll head into the break with the 1947 hit Trombonology, showcasing Tommy Dorsey. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the so-called sentimental gentleman of swing, Tommy Dorsey. My guest is Peter Levinson, who's written a big new biography. In a moment, we'll be joined by two former members of the orchestra, Ann Clark Terry and Buddy DeFranco. Peter Levinson's new bio is Tommy Dorsey, Living in a Great Big Way, and you can sure hear it. What do you think? You can join us. Can you hear a country in depression and war yearning for the exotic, the romantic, the up? And what's the nation, the culture that emerges in the Tommy Dorsey sound? What buttons were the big bands pushing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Decades on, Dorsey's music still makes you want to get up and dance. Boogie Woogie Here was a minor hit when it was first released in 1938. It became a major hit in 1943 when no band records were being made during a musician's strike. Peter Levinson talked to us about that. This one sat on the shelf for 5 years before it really broke out?
That's what happened, yes. Just as in 1943, All or Nothing at All became an enormous hit for Frank Sinatra. It sold supposedly 8,000 copies when it was released in 1939, but it did over 100,000 when it was re-released in 1943. There was, of course, James Petrillo was head of the union, and he thought that keeping musicians away from recording would give them more opportunity to work. Of course, it did just the opposite, and the public hungered for band records. And so to have this re-released, it suddenly became a bigger hit than the first time.
Tommy Dorsey had the sort of branding of the sentimental gentleman. You've talked with a lot of people who worked with him, and they describe something pretty different, a real volcanic temper and temperament here. How did he get the sentimental gentleman label, and what was the reality behind that?
Well, that was a publicist moniker, which was brought to him. Originally, Benny Goodman was the king of swing, which actually... Gene Krupa had something to do with giving that title to him. And then Artie Shaw's publicist, I was later Artie Shaw's publicist in his last years, but he was called the king of the clarinet. And, of course, the third one to break through was Dorsey, so he had to have his moniker, and he became the sentimental gentleman of swing, based on his theme, I'm getting sentimental over you.
But the fact is,
the real Tommy Dorsey was... What's that? I'm sorry.
Behind that, a real volcano split up his band, sent Tommy off on his own. What was he like?
Yet he had a very generous streak in them. He could be very kind and generous and really help out people in distress. But I think the central thing is that person had to be a very good musician. As Joe Stafford said, he didn't give any trouble to those. It was only those who would mess up that he really would let them know it. And, of course, one of his favorite expressions was, nobody leaves this band, I only fire people. And, of course, as anybody DeFranco will tell you, when he left the band voluntarily, Dorsey did not like it at all.
And how did that work when you've got a great big band and all these personalities to hold together to have that kind
That's part of leadership, and there's no question. As a matter of fact, a wonderful woman who only died about 6 weeks ago, who I talked to six or seven times, and she was just so generous in what she gave me, an intelligent and charming, a woman named Kay Weber, who is the vocalist for the Dorsey Brothers Orchestra, said, you know, Bruce Springsteen is known as the boss. In my mind, Tommy Dorsey was always the boss.
We want to hear from some of the musicians who worked with Tommy Dorsey. We're going to hear in just a moment from one of his vocalists. Vocalists featured very prominently with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. Among them, the Clark Sisters from North Dakota, who performed under the name The Sentimentalists. Here they sing one of their big hits, On the Sunny Side of the Street, from 1944.
Leave your worries, leave them on the doorstep. Life's sweet. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Hop on that pitter pat. You know that happy tune is my step. Life's story. If you dig that beat on the sunny side of the street.
Four Clark sisters from North Dakota sang and toured with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra from 1943 to 46. They were called the Sentimentalists. Ann Clark Terry was among them. She was 22 years old when she first started touring with Dorsey. Her sister Jean was 24, Peggy was 20, Mary was 19. Ann Clark Terry joins us from Kalispell, Montana. Ann Clark Terry, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So there you and your sisters are all those years ago. How does that hit your ear today? Do you still listen back to it?
Do I still listen to it?
Sure.
Oh, of course. It's fun to hear it on your show.
Well, it's fun to hear it anytime, anywhere. What was it like to get picked up by the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra in those days?
Oh, it was a thrill. We needed a job so bad, and we were just tickled to death to be with such a great band.
How did it happen? How did you get connected with such a big one?
Well, we had been touring with the USO, and one of my sisters, Jean, has a bad hip, and she got so she couldn't walk, and my dad came and got her and took her to Mayo Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went back to New York to regroup, and Mary came to take Jean's place. We were at that time just a trio.
Yeah.
Mary came and took Jean's place, and all of a sudden Jean shows up. She's fine. So she said, well, let's go four ways. So we made a quartet out of it. And Gene was still, recovering. So when the office called and wanted us to come over and audition for Tommy, Gene says, no way, we're not going until we can make a good impression.
Yeah.
Because she couldn't walk good.
Right.
And so we called and said, we can't, you know, we'd love to sing for you, but you'd have to come over here. Well, they said Tommy Dorsey wouldn't walk across the street to hear the Pope and the Rabbi sing a duet. But anyway, he sent Cy Oliver and his manager over to hear us sing. And we sang for him in the house, in our apartment.
Yeah.
And we got the job, and we were thrilled to death.
What was it like to work for Tommy Dorsey? We're hearing from Peter Levinson that he could be quite a taskmaster, a real perfectionist.
Well, I'm sure he was, but he was very generous to the to us girls. I mean, he never, ever did anything that was out of hand, and he, if he was going to speak rough to the boys, he'd send us out of the room.
And what kind of touring did you do? How far afield? Were you touring overseas with Tommy Dorsey during
the war? No, we didn't go overseas. Well, we did go as far as Canada, but that was it. And then back and forth across the country here, from New York to Los Angeles and back again. And a couple of times we did that.
Ann Clark Terry, bring a night or two to life for us. What were some venues or some crowds that just really ripped open in response to your music? Do you remember nights that were just unforgettable?
I think they all were. I can't remember one that wasn't. We had wonderful audiences of people just thronged. In those days, they were starving for music, and they came out in droves, and it was just great fun. I'll never forget playing Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
You could smell the chocolate as you were approaching the town,
right.
And it was wonderful. And being at the age we were, that really went over big with us.
And paint a picture for us, the kind of venues you'd play, how people dressed, how they danced, the atmosphere.
Well, it was really fun to watch the kids dance because they were so good. They did all these. They did the Peabody that I loved to watch, and the swing thing, you know.
Sure.
And they did all kinds of dances, but they were just had so much energy, and it was just such fun to watch them. And I wished I could have been out there dancing with them. But we were sitting on the stage and stuck there, but it was just great.
I'm sure you had them on your feet. Ann Clark Terry, Peter Levinson, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. Ben is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Ben. You're on the air.
Howdy.
Hi.
I live in a very fortunate place, Astoria, home of Tony Bennett, whom I used to see sing on a park bench when he was a kid.
Oh, young boy.
I was born in 26.
Yeah.
And I can remember sitting 3 feet from Duke Ellington in a West Side club at 52nd Street when the five other guys went out to the John. It was about 4 a.m., and the doorman was getting, the maitre d' there was getting ready to kick his kick me out. I was the last guy in the club eating a 750 steak and a 40-cent cup of coffee. You could get a nickel cup of coffee anywhere in New York at the time.
And what about Tommy Dorsey, Ben?
Well, I'll get to that.
Okay.
Because it was really phenomenal. And,
yeah.
And so the I'm listening to the Duke do these little riffs and posing right before my very eyes. Mm. He puts the whole thing together, and I lean back, put down my cup of coffee, and I say, wow, that was really great. And he turns around to me, and he says, yes, indeed, young man, it certainly was.
I love it. There's the Duke.
Really great. And then I remember the first time we went to see Sinatra, the mile-long line to get into the Paramount was incredible, but we always got there early.
This is Sinatra with Tommy Dorsey you saw, Ben?
With Tommy Dorsey, his first performance with Dorsey. And I remember we used to hop on the subway for a nickel, go into Manhattan from Astoria, and, for a dime, you could get back and forth.
And how about those gals in their bobby socks? Did they like it?
They were incredible. The whole audience was rocking, I'm telling you. In those days, they didn't rock, they jumped.
Right.
Because it was really the Lindy Hop, mostly, and
right.
Stuff like that.
And
but I tell you, when the Dorsey band came on,
yeah.
It was mellow. You know, he was really mellow. But you had a hunch that what they said about him being a tough guy with the band was true, because sometimes he'd stare at somebody in the back row, you know, or, you could tell the band was on, like, pins and needles because it had to be perfect.
And you could see it in Tommy Dorsey's eyes. Ben, we appreciate, I should say thanks for the memories, I guess, is the only thing we can say there. That's just terrific. Ann Clark Terry, you're 84 now.
Not quite, but I'm gaining on it.
Okay, forgive me then.
That's okay.
83. When you put music on, when you turn to what you want to listen to today, what is it? Do you still put these records on?
That's my kind of music. The swing music was just great. I just loved it. And that fellow that you just had on painted a very tough picture of Tommy, and I don't think it was quite like that. No, Tommy was You know, he did. He was tough with the guys. He wanted perfection, but he didn't keep them on pins and needles. It was a much more relaxed feeling all around, through, on the bus and on the train and on the stand and everything. It was a very relaxed band.
And I want to bring in another former member of the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. Buddy DeFranco joins us from Panama City Beach, Florida, considered one of the greatest jazz clarinetists of all time.
He's the best.
A jazz master in the National Academy of the Arts, member of the American Jazz Hall of Fame. When he was 14, he won a National Tommy Dorsey Talent Contest in 1944, recruited by Tommy Dorsey to join the orchestra, played with him on and off throughout the 40s, went on to tour with Billie Holiday to lead the Glenn Miller Band and a whole lot more. 82 now. Buddy DeFranco, we're so honored to have you with us. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much.
You're hearing some of Ann's stories, remembering...
Oh, you believe everything she says.
No.
Hi, Buddy.
How you doing, Ann?
Great.
Buddy, how about those days
those
and Tommy
days
Dorsey?
Something.
Yeah, no kidding. We heard a little bit of Opus Number 1 before, but we didn't quite get to your clarinet solo, and I want to bring that up just to hear how grand it was. Buddy DeFranco with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra.
I was going to say just as well.
No, here it goes. Wow, just have to love it. Buddy DeFranco on clarinet, Buddy Rich on drums there. Buddy DeFranco, what was it like working for Tommy Dorsey? He wanted the best, you gave it to him, but what about when he didn't get the best?
What about when he what?
When he didn't get the best, was he as volcanic as Peter Levinson leads us to believe here?
He was the most, I guess he was bigger than life, and he was every kind of character type wrapped up in one.
Give us some of them. What do you mean?
Well, let me see. Zoot Sims once said Tommy Dorsey is a great bunch of guys.
I love it. Who were they?
Well, there was the one that was the perfectionist and a marvelous trombonist, probably the best ever. Great musician, marvelous player, and a perfectionist. He demanded that he was perfect, pretty near, and he demanded everybody else would be. So... it was pretty strict that way. He wanted it clean and perfect. At any rate, that's one of his character types. Yeah. Another character type was few people know, he was very generous. I mean, not only with the salaries. If he wanted someone in his band, he'd pay them what they asked, what they wanted. And I remember being very very ill in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
I had I forget what it was, but I had to go to the hospital. And I went to the hospital for a week. The band went on traveling, and they got a substitute for me.
Yeah.
And when I left the hospital, I never saw a bill, and he had his doctor fly in from New York City to take care of me.
Wow.
And I got my salary for that week.
Of course, you were quite an asset. You had to be taken care of. Buddy DeFranco, when you look back, what was the country responding to in this music? What was the kind of core spirit at the heart of this music?
I didn't get that one.
What was the spirit at the heart of this music that had America up on its feet and so enthused?
Well, first of all, it was, of course, the beat. The beat had to be there. But I think on top of that, there was a certain sophistication about the music that people gravitated toward. If you hear all those arrangements, they were really arranged in such a complex way, but yet smooth, sophisticated. And most music now, today,
yeah,
have lost that sophistication. They still have the beat. So that people can dance to it.
No question. Ann Clark Terry, a lot of beat there, but in a people's music, but as Buddy DeFranco says, a lot of sophistication, too.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And the smoothest. When they played a ballad, there wasn't anything better than that.
That's right. And also, the lyrics and the songs were mostly about love and pretty happy.
That's for sure.
And that's really changed over the years. I don't know. We get so much anger in our songs today.
It's ironic. Even in the face of depression and war, all that love and moonlight. Ann Clark Terry with us from Kalispell, Montana today, one of the four Clark sisters that sang with Tommy Dorsey. Thank you so much for joining us. Wonderful to have you.
Well, thank you for letting me be a part of this.
It's great to have you. And Buddy DeFranco in Panama City Beach, Florida, the great one on the clarinet. Wonderful to have you, Mr. DeFranco. Thanks for joining us.
See you soon, Ann, and see you, Tom.
Thank you. Peter Levinson, author of Tommy Dorsey, Living in a Great Big Way, please stand by. We'll head into this break with the 1937 hit, Song of India. It was the B-side of the record, Marie. Both were breakthrough hits for the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the great big band leader Tommy Dorsey, one of the titans of the big band era. Part of his genius was his ability to find the stars of the future. Here a young Frank Sinatra performs on the 1940 Tommy Dorsey Orchestra recording, East of the Sun.
East of the sun,
Big Ben, the brightness,
and west of the moon,
I'll be digging the globe.
We'll build a dream house,
a righteous path
of love,
where you can really lay it on me.
Near to the sun in the day,
we'll be jumping,
and near to the moon at night,
you'll be with me.
We'll live in a lovely way, dear.
Solitude, I'm hit.
Living on love. Pale moonlight.
Hello.
Just you and I.
We'll mix the square.
Frank Sinatra with Tommy Dorsey Orchestra's East of the Sun. We're joined this hour by Peter Levinson, author of the new biography, Tommy Dorsey, Living in a Great Big Way. You can join us, too. Were you part of it? Were you part of the swing scene? Have you seen your grandparents get misty over these tunes? Do they get under your skin? What was that time? What was that sound? Jason's calling from Waterloo, Iowa. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hello there, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
I just have a story to share about I happened to have your show on, and I immediately thought of a family story. My grandfather was a big band aficionado.
Okay.
And he they came into town. They played at Electric Park Ballroom.
You're talking about Tommy or Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey?
Yes, Tommy and Jimmy together, and
came into Waterloo, Iowa. So we're talking way back, 1930 time.
Yes, and it was quite an event for this town. And we never have had much music come here, as you said before, people were starving for music, and especially here.
Yeah.
And they just took, as my grandfather said, they just took the roof off this town. And my mother was very young at the time, and she was downstairs, and I guess it was my grandfather lived a ways out, and after the show they came back to my grandfather's house and listened to music and imbibed, and they got involved in a very heated argument.
What you're saying, Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey came back to your grandfather's house in Waterloo and did some drinking? Is that what I heard you say?
Yes. Yeah, there was a wet bar there where they found the wet bar. And Yeah, and I guess everybody had a grand time. My grandfather loved to have musical acts that came in town that he promoted and took care of different things for him, and loved to have them over.
But it sounded like it ended up a little messy there.
It did. I from what I hear, there wasn't a lot of specifics or anything, but my mother recalls hearing Tommy and Jimmy having a very heated argument about the music, and it was concerning the music, and it went on for quite some time. And then they, my grandfather, I guess, broke it up.
So pretty much a Dorsey Brothers fight going on there in Waterloo, Iowa. Jason, it's a great story. Thank you very much for bringing it in. Peter Levinson, how about it? These brothers, and especially Tommy, could live pretty hard, too. This wouldn't be the only night that he hit the bottle after the show.
Well, I think, as I pointed out, in Living in a Great Big Way, mm-hmm. tempo was often a source of a great deal of trouble. As a matter of fact, their breakup at the Glen Allen Casino in 1935 was specifically over tempo. And even when they got back together, the way it worked, with Jimmy would play the first set, having the band play a lot of his hits, and then Tommy and so forth and so on for the 4 hours of dances. And as Tommy would leave the stand, Jimmy would say, "Mac, you still got the wrong tempo." So the tempo was always a problem, and I would assume that that situation in Waterloo may have had something to do with that very fact.
And hitting the wet bar, your book isn't shy on that that side.
No,
of Tommy Dorsey's
life. Both were quite large as drinkers. Tommy was sober for many years, and then actually what he would do is drink turpentine, that cough medicine, which would give him a high. And then in his latter years, the drinking was on and off, and as the guitarist Bob Bain said something about, we all wished he'd start drinking again, because when he was sober, he was even more difficult. But at the end, of course, he started using uppers a lot, and that had a lot to do with the way he died, actually. He had a combination of, I got the police report from the Greenwich Police Department. He died from a meal of, I believe it was veal parmesan and steak, two glasses of red wine and uppers. And, of course, he suffocated and threw up all over himself and suffocated. And he was 1 week past his 51st birthday.
Yeah, only 51. Outsized appetites, as you write as well, for the women in his life.
Oh, yes. And, of course, in his second wife, Pat Dane, he had what he really wanted, which was a very erotic woman who was an MGM starlet. He had met her at MGM when he was under contract there, and she was quite a lady in a lot of aspects, and they were only married about, I believe, just under 4 years. And when, in those days, a woman getting divorced would go to Reno and establish a residence of 6 weeks, and then they could get a divorce. And when she returned, when she went to Reno, Tommy bought a Cadillac convertible for her to drive to Reno. Mm. Then she came back, and the first night she was back, she went out with her ex-husband. Mm.
Tommy did his own stepping out on a pretty big scale, as I read you, Peter Levinson.
Oh, yes. He loved women very, very much.
Enough said? Or do you have stories to tell?
For instance, with his first wife, Toots, who was, as they say, a civilian. She was not in show business. Mm-hmm. She was a woman he had met when, actually, they were both teenagers. I believe she was 17 and he was 19 or something close to that. Mm-hmm. It's in the book. I forgot the exact years. But that was when he was with a Gene Goldcat band, and he met her at a party where the band was playing. And he had two children with her. And then Pat Dane was the second one, and his third wife was had been a showgirl. She wasn't that tall, but mm-hmm. she had been a chorus dancer at the Copacabana and nightclubs in Florida, and he had two children by her. But there were many, many women, including people like Tallulah Bankhead and Doris Day and others in between and during those relationships.
You couldn't get much bigger on the national stage than a big band leader, and he was a very...
That's right. They were pop stars of the day.
Yeah.
And, of course, I think, Tom, another aspect is the fact that, Jan Winner, the editor and publisher of Rolling Stone, would have you believe that bizarre behavior started with Mick Jagger and The Who and stuff like that.
Not so,
Tommy
not
Dorsey
so.
Was very much of a rock star, and he was from the 1930s, 40s, and 50s.
Yeah. Speaking of stars, we heard Frank Sinatra there at the top of the section.
Yeah.
I want to go back and hear something else that he did. I'll Never Smile Again, this song from 1939, written by young Canadian songwriter Ruth Lowe. Her husband, Harold, died in World War II. She told her sister that she would never smile again without him, and then she sat down and wrote a song to express exactly that sentiment. It was the song, it turns out, that launched Frank Sinatra's career. Let's listen to a bit of that.
Until I smile at you, I'll never laugh again. What good would it do?
Peter Levinson, how did Tommy Dorsey connect with Frank Sinatra, and what kind of singer was Frank Sinatra when Dorsey and Sinatra got together?
Well, he had been with Harry James, and Harry's band was really in a lot of trouble. In reality, Tommy Dorsey helped finance Harry James in that first year of 39. His band was really scuffling. It couldn't get established. And Dorsey's great vocalist, Jack Leonard, left, and then in typical Dorsey fashion, he had two other vocalists who lasted about a total of 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had his manager, Bobby Burns, write on a torn-off piece of a paper bag and gave it to a man named Nick Savano, who was working for Sinatra's valet on the James Band, saying, Tommy Dorsey would like to meet you in his suite tomorrow at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm.
And he did. And, of course, he had met him before this at a time when Bob Chester, an orchestra that Dorsey had financed because of Glenn Miller had borrowed money from Tommy twice. They had met on the Dorsey Brothers Band. He was the chief arranger, and they've been friends for years. And then Tommy financed Glenn twice when he was trying to make it with his first band and didn't succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second time, Tommy said, all right, now I've loaned money to you twice. Yeah, you've paid me back, but I want a piece of this band. And Tommy said, or rather Glenn said, absolutely not. I've paid you back. You're not going to get a piece of my orchestra. And then Dorsey went out and financed Bob Chester, trying to knock off Glenn Miller, because shortly thereafter, Glenn broke through in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
And so there, one day in New York, Sinatra was coming in to audition for the Bob Chester Orchestra, and Dorsey sat at a table in a studio. The band was set up to play, and he saw Dorsey, and he absolutely froze and walked out of the place. He later worked for Chester a few weeks,
yeah.
So that when Dorsey confronted Sinatra about coming with his band, he said, I remember you're the guy who couldn't get the words out when you saw me. All right, you're going to audition for me now. And he had him sing Marie, and then, of course, he hired him. And that volatile relationship was quite something. And, of course, in the book, I've gotten the contract, which everybody's talked about for 60 years, but nobody's ever seen before, wherein when Sinatra left, Dorsey insisted that he sign a contract with him as his manager and would take 33 1/3% of all future earnings. And then, of course, there was the big brouhaha about getting Sinatra out of that contract. He wound up giving Dorsey $60,000. He had borrowed $17,000, and Dorsey got $43,000 on top of that.
Wow. So Tommy Dorsey, I mean, he boosted Frank Sinatra, but he was a thorn in the side once
he
left.
Oh, yes. And,
of
course, I've traced the relationship all the way through. I think, Tom, one of the aspects of my book, which I think is very important, I knew Frank Sinatra I didn't know him well, but I knew him for 37 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationship with Dorsey was on and off all the way to the end. They could never be friends because they were too much of the same type. But the main point is that everybody knows the musical influence that Tommy Dorsey had on Frank Sinatra.
Mm-hmm.
What no biographer has ever attached themselves to is the fact that Tommy Dorsey's powerful personality was exactly what Frank Sinatra's personality became. For instance, Buddy DeFranco said the entire personalities of Buddy Rich and Frank Sinatra come right out of Tommy Dorsey.
Yep.
The trumpet player Buddy Childress said, Buddy Rich tried hard to be Dorsey. He didn't make it. Frank Sinatra came pretty close.
And you mean that domineering, hard-driving, living
That's
large
right. it's,
personality?
It's, yes, and destroy your enemies, take care of your friends, have parties for them, pick up the check, do very nice things for them. The perfectionism, the discipline musically, there's a lot of aspects I name in the book that both of those gentlemen shared.
This was beauty and this was art, but this was also big, tough business, and maybe we see it in both Tommy Dorsey and Frank Sinatra.
Absolutely.
Lisa's calling from Boston. Hi, Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I was calling because I am part of the swing revival. I've been dancing here in Boston for the last 6 or 7 years. I have always appreciated swing music ever since my parents bought me my first clock radio, and my parents happened to stop on a station that was playing swing music, and I was hooked. And I was so happy 6 or 7 years ago when it first started coming around again, and I could actually dance to it the way that it was meant to be enjoyed. And, you know, everything from Tommy Dorsey and Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday, everyone, it's such great music, and even though it was during difficult times, to me, it kind of also, you know, calls to mind a time of more innocence when things weren't as complicated.
And Lisa, when you spend an evening deep in the swing, just dancing the night away, where does it take you? Where does it leave you?
Utterly exhausted, but exuberant. The music to me is pure joy. You can't help but move to it.
Lisa, we love that it's out there and that it's still happening, and we can feel it, how it gets your feet moving. Thanks for calling. Peter Levinson,
yes.
So the country floated on this music through those.
Oh, yes.
I mean,
it
really carried the culture along in many ways.
Oh, yes, very definitely. I mean, I think Opus Number 1, which, of course, you featured back here early in the show, really represents the exuberance of swing just about more than anything else could.
And earlier in those Depression years, the kind of sweetness that helped people.
Yes. And of course, another point is to bring out, I think, is by about 1940, when I'll Never Smile Again became an enormous hit in the first half of 1948, to be exact, remember that was the draft had started, and the idea was that war was coming to the United States. It came, about 2 years later, the end of 1941. Mm-hmm. But there was no doubt that this country was headed for war. And, of course, young men were going into the armed services, and their loved ones said, well, will they ever come back? And there became a definite melancholy streak in the music, and I'll Never Smile Again was very reflective of that melancholy which was hitting the nation in early 1940.
Peter Levinson's new biography is Tommy Dorsey, Living in a Great Big Way. We've got a photo gallery of some of the highlights of Tommy Dorsey's career at our website, onpointradio.org. Peter Levinson, we're going to go out on Hawaiian war chant, 1938. Tell us about this. Very exotic. We just got a few seconds. What was going on?
Well, that's
here?
A driving Cy Oliver arrangement, at least I think it is, and it shows the exuberance of that band and Buddy Rich and Ziggy Elman. It's a powerful, powerful performance of trumpet and drums, of course.
No kidding. Buddy Rich in a big way there. Peter Levinson, wonderful to have you with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
So much.
I've enjoyed this.
Peter Levinson's new book, Tommy Dorsey, Living in a Great Big Way. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.